Hi, this is Ken Ripple of Chariot Solutions. This is the Philly Emerging Tech Podcast number one with Chris Richardson, Head of Cloud Development at SpringSource. Today's talk is called Polyglot Persistence for Java Developers, Moving Out of the Relational Comfort Zone. So this talk is all about NoSQL databases from Redis to SimpleDB, MongoDB, and Cassandra, looking at the data models for each of them and also their Java APIs. He's also going to get into talking about what NoSQL benefits are and the drawbacks. And then you'll learn a little bit about the Spring Data Project. So again, this is Chris Richardson, a friend of ETE. He's been here a number of years, and we know him well. And this is called Polyglot Persistence for Java Developers. Chariot is sponsoring a one-day practical DevOps seminar on October 18th, 2011. Learn how to tightly integrate your development and operations experts and improve the quality and rapidity in producing your software. The one-day $99 conference includes talks from Sonatype's Jason Van Zyl, CloudBees, Puppet Labs, and two real-world case studies from Fortune 500 companies. The show will wrap up with a panel discussion that will take your questions from each of our speakers. Don't miss this highly informative, low-cost event. More information is available at chariotsolutions.com/devops-seminar or by clicking the DevOps seminar link on techcast.chariotsolutions.com. Hope to see you there.
So thanks for picking this session on NoSQL databases for Java developers. So if you're like me, then you've probably been using a relational database for as long as you can remember. You know, back in the 90s, I was using Oracle or Microsoft SQL Server. Though, of course, in more recent years, been using open source databases like Postgres or MySQL. And I sort of have to think all the way back into the 80s to remember when I was using something that wasn't relational. And I think for the most part, relational databases have served us well, right? You know, they're pretty good. They've got a solid mathematical foundation, and they just sort of work as advertised. But in recent years, particularly with so-called web-scale applications and massive data and so on, the relational model has shown a few cracks. And so what we've seen over the past couple of years is the rise of the NoSQL database. And I'm going to talk about how they've sort of made these trade-offs to solve certain kinds of problems that relational databases are not good at. And so for the past few months, what I've been doing is I took a use case from my book, Pojos in Action, and I ported it to a few different NoSQL databases. And so the goal of this talk is just to show you what I found, the good points, the bad points, and so on. So yeah, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Chris Richardson. I wrote the book Pojos in Action a few years ago. Then I had a startup called Cloud Foundry, which was then acquired by SpringSource, which then got acquired by VMware 18 months ago. And I don't know if anyone's seen this. Though I should point out that it really wasn't drawn to, this is from the Register website, and I should point out that it wasn't really drawn to scale because sort of Cloud Foundry was more of a plankton. Otherwise, I'd be really wealthy right now. Anyway, so that's why I ended up working at this giant, company, VMware. And I was sort of organized in the Oakland area, the Oakland Jug, and also the Groovy Grails meetup. So that's me. So just out of interest, anyone here actually use a NoSQL database? Just a couple. So cool. So, I'm just going to look into the what are the issues with relational databases and what are the motivations for using NoSQL. Then I'm going to look in, sort of dive into some of the details of Redis, Cassandra, and MongoDB, which are three of the popular NoSQL databases. I had hoped to talk about SimpleDB, but that sort of made my presentation a little too long, and I didn't want to cut into the beer party that's afterwards. So sorry if you came here hoping to hear about SimpleDB. And then I'm going to talk about the Spring Data Project that's one of the newer open source projects at SpringSource, whose mission is to make it easier for Java developers to develop applications that use NoSQL databases. And then finally, I'm going to finish up with a sort of a detailed case study. I'm going to sort of describe how a use case from my book actually got ported and worked on Redis, Cassandra, and MongoDB. So, okay, let's get going. So, you know, relational databases are just great, right? I mean, we all understand them. They've got this solid mathematical foundation. They've got great transactional semantics, you know, that whole ACID thing. And we just know how they work, right? And they're very well supported by all of the tools or frameworks that we love, whether it's sort of JDBC or Hibernate and Spring and so on and so forth. And then, of course, operation people know how to take care of them. So they're just generally good. But then if we, you know, look into it, sort of various kind of cracks in that model have revealed themselves over the past few years, right? You've got the traditional mismatch between the object world of, you know, objects or classes and relationships, you know, rich sort of data model, and the very flat relational model. You know, it's kind of difficult to sometimes map a rich relational model into the relational schema. Also, a relational schema is very rigid. You know, if you've got a varying number of attributes per entity, it doesn't quite work and fit in the relational model too well. Or if you want to change your schema, you know, you've got a table with a gazillion rows and you need to add an extra column, usually that's, you know, downtime. You have to migrate all of the data. Or perhaps you have to fork out lots of money to use a relational database that lets you do it in real time without any downtime. And then there's just the whole issue of scalability. It tends to be very difficult or impossible or very expensive to scale writes. You tend to have to scale vertically, which, you know, obviously is incredibly expensive servers. And horizontal scalability is problematic. So in sort of the world of consumer-facing apps that have to deal with huge transaction volumes, relational databases sort of have issues. And then there are just general problems, performance problems in some cases, with using a relational database. You know, because obviously at the back end, unless we've spent a lot of money and bought solid state drives, we're using just disk drives with the usual, you know, 5 or 10 millisecond seek time. So there's a limit on, you know, how fast you can make the head on the disk drive move, which limits the number of joins you can do per second and so on. So there's sort of just problems, even though they are pretty good. And, you know, as a result, we've seen the rise of these NoSQL databases. You know, this is from Indeed.com, and you can see that, you know, in the past couple of years, they've just sort of taken off and gone off the screen, in fact. So in each one of these databases offers some combination of sort of solutions to the problem of relational databases, whether it's like super high performance or incredible scalability or support for a rich data model or schemaless data model. But in return, you've got to give up some kind of concept of transactions, and maybe you actually have to give up data consistency as well, all to kind of gain some of the benefits. If you look at the whole NoSQL space today, you know, kind of say that everyone and their dog has written one, there's a list of like 120 NoSQL databases out there, you know. Some have come out of companies like Facebook or Amazon or so on. But then there's just a huge number of open source projects. Everyone, you know, various developers have woken up one day and said, I'm going to create a NoSQL database. And so there's just a lot. And there are many different data models. Unlike in the relational world where there's just one model, there are, you know, 4 or 5 different data models in the NoSQL space. And they have different APIs, you know. So for the most part, there's no JDBC, there's no Hibernate, no JPA, et cetera. It's just very custom database-specific APIs. And there was recently an article in Q Magazine that sort of drew analogies between the state of the NoSQL universe today and the database market as it existed in the 70s before SQL came along, i.e. a bunch of sort of highly differentiated products with no commonality between them. So it's sort of an interesting state of affairs. And then, unlike at Spring One, I am not going to read this because it has a rude word in it, but this sort of cartoon here actually kind of sums up what it can be like in some cases to access a NoSQL database. And if you want to hear this acted out, if you go to InfoQ and you can listen to the Spring One presentation that I did with Mark Pollock, and about, I think, 11 minutes and 20 seconds in, we actually say that word, or he does, in a Brooklyn accent, so it sounds quite good. But, you know, this kind of, in a way, as you're going to see, kind of sums up, in some cases, what it's like to use a NoSQL database. Yeah. Also, in terms of reality check, right? You know, Oracle or MySQL, the general relational market, is huge, right? And in terms of adoption, it's like NoSQL is, well, you know, it's kind of gone from one pixel to, I think, three pixels. But then you look at the growth curve, and you can see it's sort of, you know, Oracle or whatever is one pixel down here, and NoSQL databases. So it's sort of rapidly, you know, people are adopting. There was a tremendous interest in NoSQL, in summary. And then some of you in the audience might recognize this slide from an excellent article, IEEE Software, by Debashis, who's sitting right here. This sort of, I think, summarizes really the future, sort of the architectural model that I think many applications are going to follow, namely the kind of this sort of polyglot persistence paradigm where your application is comprised of multiple modules, and each module uses a particular database that's best suited to its needs. So say the social graph part of the application could use a graph database, or another part that's storing sort of documents could use MongoDB, and then the other part that needs sort of the true ACID transaction model could use a relational database. And the different modules are exchanging messages to keep the data consistent. And so I think this is going to be a growing trend. And in fact, in Spring Data, there's already some technology that supports this model. I should say, please feel free to ask questions at any time. Okay, so that's sort of the motivation, right? Relational databases are good, but they have some issues, and so NoSQL databases have emerged to address some of those problems. So what I want to do now is just kind of have a look at a few different NoSQL databases, starting with Redis, and then Cassandra, and then MongoDB. Okay, so the first one is Redis, and that's an open source project. And it describes itself as an advanced key value store. So in other words, you know, if you go look at, say, I mean, an example of a regular key value store would be Memcached, right? Where it's basically a hash map server where you put a value in and you get a value out. But Redis actually takes this a step further because the values that you can put in and get out aren't just simple strings or simple arrays of bytes. They can actually be complex values themselves. So a particular value could be a set, it could be a list, it could be an ordered set, or it could actually be a hash map. There's only one level of recursion there. And then there are operations for actually manipulating each type of data. So there's a command to add a value to a set or remove a value from a set. So you've sort of got a server that's, you know, basically it's a data structure server. And it's primarily in memory, and it's blindingly fast. For instance, if the values are quite small, on some just basic kind of hardware, a single Redis server can do 100,000 operations a second. Though if you end up with larger values, the throughput declines somewhat. But it's also persistent. It actually can either take a persistent snapshot of its memory and write that to disk, or it can append all of the commands that you execute to a log file. So you actually get, you know, a fair amount of durability, even though the data is basically in memory. And it even has some concept of transactions, in as much as commands can be batched and executed in an atomic fashion that for the most part works. So there's sort of some edge cases. So it's sort of, you know, mostly transactional. So Redis has a CLI, and so what I'm doing here is I'm just typing in some commands that manipulate a set. So there's an sadd command that adds a element to a set. So my set is the key, and A is the element I'm adding to the set, and then so I'm adding element B. And then I can get the members of the set, and then I can remove a member from the set and get the members and so on. And so those commands that you're typing in basically correspond to the commands in the Redis wire protocol. And so for list, you'll see similar operations for like pushing and popping or slicing. likewise for a hash map and so on. So that's sort of kind of Redis in a nutshell. And in terms of sort of scaling Redis, there's a few things you can do. It supports master-slave replications, so you can have a tree of Redis servers. And there's an interesting approach where the master is actually non-persistent, so it doesn't incur the overhead of writing to disk, but then it replicates to a slave that is persistent. And then you can sort of scale out by sharding. So this is only supported client-side, so you use some kind of consistent hashing scheme. So if you've got three Redis servers, then you use some kind of hashing scheme to partition the key space between those three servers. And you can also run multiple servers on a physical host because the Redis server is actually single-threaded. And there's some concept of virtual memory when the data doesn't quite fit inside RAM, but it's probably best not to use that. So what do you do with this? Well, one common use case is simply as a drop-in replacement for Memcached. So for storing things like session state or as a cache of data that you retrieve from a relational database, or you could use it because it's more than just put and, get and put. You could actually use it, as my example shows later, as sort of a high-speed data store for data, for denormalized data. And there's sort of a few interesting use cases if you go look around the web, like using hit count, like maintaining hit counts on URLs. You can just use the increment operation where the key is the URL or digest of the URL, and it just increments the key value by one, and so it's a very fast operation. If you need to randomly select an item, you can maintain a set of items and then just pick one at random using srandmember, which is actually incredibly difficult to, or inefficient if you try and do that with a SQL database. And then queuing, you can use pop and push, and then high score tables and so on. So there's a bunch of different use cases that it's ideally suited for. Common kinds of data operations that you need to do on your website and don't quite fit in a relational database. And there's a few notable people using it, like GitHub apparently uses it. I think GuardianCo.uk, which is sort of a large online newspaper site, uses it as well. Okay, so that's Redis. I'm going to go sort of look at how you can code against it in a little while. So second database I want to talk about is Cassandra. So that's an Apache open source project, which was developed by Facebook, apparently just to support inbox search. And you're going to see it's actually got a different data model from Redis. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But it's designed to be extremely scalable. So you can actually have a cluster of Redis servers that you can expand and contract dynamically, and the data is repartitioned. And you can even have part of that cluster in another data center, and it sort of does the right thing. It's incredibly fast because the actual act, when you do a write again to Redis, all it's doing is appending that data to a kind of a transaction log. So there's just serial I/O and there's no very few seeks. And so it actually has, read the docs, it actually has really interesting behavior such that writes are actually faster than reads with this database, which is very different from a relational model. The data model, describes itself as a column-oriented database. And what I found is that that phrase just does nothing but confuse you, really. I mean, because it sort of sounds like a database column, but it actually behaves quite differently. So one way of thinking about it is what Cassandra gives you is a multi-dimensional hash map. Perhaps that confuses you even further. But it took me a while to wrap my head around it. So basically, what you end up with is at the highest level on Cassandra, you have a key space, which is kind of analogous to a schema on a relational database server. And then within that key space, you have one or more column families. And column families are kind of like tables, more or less. And then they have rows, and rows obviously have keys. And then, but each row can have an arbitrary number of columns. So unlike in a relational model where you have a fixed set of columns that you have to sort of define up front, in the Cassandra data model, you have an arbitrary number of columns. And so in a way, you could actually view each row in a column family as a hash map of some kind. And so, as you're going to see in a little bit, the names of the columns aren't just fixed as they are in a relational model, but they actually tend to contain data as well. And it might not be too obvious from this, but if you've got something like a domain-driven design terms, an aggregate, self-contained hierarchy of objects like an order, purchase order, shopping cart, or whatever, you could actually represent that as a single row inside a column family, because you can have an arbitrary number of column names and values in there. So the actual, in terms of how you manipulate it, basically one operation is you can do an insert, and so it's against a particular column family, and you just specify the key, the column name, which remember is just arbitrary data, and a column value, and that just adds that new column into the given row identified by the key. So we've got, this row now has a fourth value in there. And the scope of a transaction changes to a single row within a column family. And then in terms of getting data out, there's a few options, but one useful one is what's called a slice. So you specify a key that identifies a row, and then you specify a range of columns. So you specify the starting column name and the ending column name, and it just gives you a slice of columns out of that row. It's very different. And you can also, there's also sort of a two-dimensional range slice where you specify a range of keys and a range of columns. So you're sort of doing the range that way and a slice that way. And later on, I'll sort of give you an example of how you can use that. But wait, there's more. There's also this concept of a super column, which actually adds an additional dimension to this sort of structure. So you actually have a row in a super column family is comprised of super columns. And the super columns, each super column can contain a collection of columns. So it's, in a way, each row is like a map of hash maps. So you've sort of got an extra level. Hence, we're kind of like in the fifth dimension here. So insert specifies the super column name as well as the column name and so on. And then there's a super slice operation as well, which you specify a range of super column names, and that gives you all of the columns in all of this matching super columns. Told you it messes. I told you it messes with your head. And there's a CLI that you can play around with as well. And then in terms of scalability, there's this concept that you can think of the servers forming a ring, and each server is responsible is assigned a kind of a key value or token, and it's responsible for the range of key values between it and its predecessor. And there's some concept of replication as well. And the idea here is you can just add and subtract members from this ring, and it repartitions itself and so on. So in terms of, well, what do people do with this? Well, the number one use case, I think, is just big data. Like, you've just got, gigabytes, terabytes of data, because this system just scales. Like, the website talks about a 100-terabyte system over 150 machines. Also for logging as well, because writes are really fast, you can just blast data into it extremely quickly. And there's a few sites, that well-known sites, that are using it. Okay, so now I'm going to sort of change gears and sort of go from that mind-warping column-oriented model to the document-oriented database, MongoDB. And the model here is a lot friendlier than sort of the previous two that we've looked at. And basically, you know, when you hear the term document, you think, well, Word, I mean, I thought Word document or something. How does that fit in with the, fit into this? But actually what you get is a, it's actually JSON documents. So in other words, a document is a, it can be is effectively a map, you know, name value pairs where the values can themselves be maps or they can be lists or they can be primitive. So it's very much like a JSON document. And then these JSON documents are organized into collections, you know, which basically play the role of tables. And in terms of, well, what do you do with it? Well, you can, you know, add a document to a collection, you can find documents within the collection, you can delete a document from a collection. And there's plus there's a support for sort of in-place kind of updates of documents as well. And what's really nice about it is it actually has a rich query language for dynamic queries. Out of practically all of the NoSQL databases, it actually has a query language that makes it feel like a, you know, that's rich and powerful, like SQL in a sense. It has support for indexes as well. So here's an example of a document. So actually, it's sort of describing my favorite Indian restaurant in Berkeley. So, you know, you've got a name attribute, a type attribute, the service area is a collection of zip codes, and then the opening hours is actually a list of sub-documents, so describing that this restaurant's open on Mondays between 5:30 and 9:30. And then it's also got the Mongo object ID in there as well. So pretty rich structure, and that's actually in the that, you know, with this structure, you could represent a complex tree of objects, you know, an entire purchase order, a shopping cart, or just, you know, some entity out of your application. And the interesting thing about this is that it's stored as a sequence of bytes on disk. So to save it or to restore it, or load it rather, you don't actually, you just write it out or read it in. You don't have to do seeks, you know, large number of seeks as you would have to do if this was a relational database. And then, as a result, MongoDB tends to be blindingly fast. You know, once again, you've got to give something up, and of course, in this case, transactions, the scope of a transaction is simply the an update or set of updates to a single document. So you can't sort of update two documents atomically within the same transaction. You know, and it has the nice shell, which where you actually type in JavaScript expressions. So, you know, I'm logging in, picking a database, creating a couple of documents, and then saving each one in the restaurants collection. And then I'm doing a query where I'm just finding all restaurants whose, and here's a regular expression whose name begins with A. And then I'm doing a in-place update of all of the documents. Well, of course, there's only one, but if any document matched that kind of query, it would just change its name to that. So it's kind of like doing an update statement in SQL. And as sort of I hinted at, the query language is quite rich, and it actually uses sort of a query by example approach. So you create a document that sort of matches the kinds of documents you're looking for. So here was, you know, if we want to find a restaurant whose service area contains 94619, you just write service area colon 94619. And then we want to find the restaurant that has an opening hours that's open on Monday before 6 o'clock in the evening and closes after 6 o'clock in the evening. So because this is an array of sub-documents, we do use that LM match operator. So, you know, pretty rich kind of query language. And then to, in terms of executing it using raw Mongo API, you invoke find, passing in the Java representation of that object. It gives you back a cursor, and you just iterate through it. You know, it has a nice database feel to it. Doesn't mess with your head or anything like that. And it's also scalable as well. It supports sharding. So you can partition the you can spread a collection across multiple servers, And then each of those shards can itself be replicated, can also be replicated as a concept of replica sets, where you actually have a master or a primary server that replicates data to one or more secondary servers. And if your primary goes down, then the remaining secondaries sort of elect a new master. So you get a new, you get automatic failover, which is quite nice. So it's quite a nice database. And, you know, various use cases. I think real-time analytics is a common one because MongoDB actually is very fast at writing, so you can just pump lots of data into it. And it's used at a few places like Shutterfly and Foursquare and so on. As I mentioned, there's a lot of other NoSQL databases. There's a website that's got a list of 122 different NoSQL databases. And I just picked these at random because they just seemed interesting and popular and so on. But kind of left out some quite significant ones. So obviously there's SimpleDB, which is Amazon's hosted NoSQL database. It's got yet another data model and another way of querying it. There's Neo4j, that's a really interesting graph database. That's particularly relevant, because many sites need to have some social networking capability, right? And what's a social network? It's just a graph. And so having a database that can query graphs very efficiently is pretty relevant. There's also CouchDB, which is a document-oriented database. And one of its distinctive things is that, it's replicated, and one database can be, databases can be disconnected, and then when they reconnect, they can sync up, which is quite useful if one database is on a mobile device, for example. There's others that are out there, like a buddy of mine, I think he's using HBase, for example. Okay, so that's sort of a very brief overview of NoSQL databases. So I want to sort of shift gears and talk about the Spring Data Project. But first, each one of these databases has some kind of Java client API. So Redis, there's a few different client libraries out there. The way I sort of put in bold the ones that are preferred. Cassandra, it uses Thrift, which is some language-neutral RPC mechanism. And if you wanted to, you could just use raw Thrift, but I've tried that and it hurts. So you kind of have to use a higher-level client library, and there's one called Hector, which actually, to be honest, doesn't seem great, but it's better than nothing. And then MongoDB has a nice Java driver, and they also have a Scala driver, Casbar, I think it's called. So, but of course, and then in addition to Java, there's support for, many other languages as well. But sort of what's particularly interesting is this sort of big new project at SpringSource, which is the Spring Data Project, and it's sort of that goal is to sort of bring the traditional Spring value proposition to the NoSQL world. In other words, if you're programming with a NoSQL database, then Spring Data, its goal is to make it a lot easier. So in the same way that, with Spring simplified JDBC development with the JDBC template classes, or Hibernate development with a Hibernate template class, and so on. So Spring Data, its goal is to just provide similar mechanisms for the NoSQL space to just hide all of that boilerplate and lower level code, enabling you to sort of focus on your business problem. So you'll see various template classes. And there's some concept of portability, but that's sort of a big can of worms that I don't really want to get into just because, these databases are quite different. But there are features of Spring Data that can give you some level of portability. And there's a whole bunch of sort of different features. So, templates, there's a concept of generic repositories where you define an interface for each of your entities, and Spring Data generates the actual implementation class for your repository. There's even support for cross-store persistence, where you can put part of your data in J- persist it with JPA and then persist part of your data or part of a subset of the fields from your JPA entity in a NoSQL database. Bunch of different sub-projects, and they're all sort of organized around the data model. So, you know, Spring data for MongoDB, Spring data for Redis, and so on. And there are sort of various stages, like Spring data for Neo4j was released just the other week, version 1.0, whereas, say, Spring data for Redis and MongoDB are still milestone releases. So, you know, just to give you a sense of what the, you know, Spring data is trying to do, I just wanted to talk very briefly about the Mongo support. So a key thing there is there's a Mongo template class that's got various convenience methods. Then it sits on top of the Mongo driver. And the sort of the big thing it does here is just hide all the sort of the boilerplate. It's not quite as bad as using JDBC, but there's still some complexity. And it also does exception translation. So Mongo exceptions get translated into Spring data access exceptions. So it just kind of your app, you know, your data access objects, even though they're written for a NoSQL database, still just fit into the Spring programming model. And then the other key feature that it provides are these converter classes. So it can convert your application POJO, your application domain domain object, into a MongoDB document and back again. So when you call insert, for example, you pass your entity, the template uses the converter to convert that entity into a document and pass it to the Mongo driver. Conversely, when you do a query, you get back a list of documents. It uses the converter to convert each document back into one of your application entities, which is quite nice. And there's a couple of different schemes. One uses just straightforward reflection or bean introspection, rather. And then the other one, Mongo Mapping Converter, actually uses an annotation-based approach to do the mapping. And that's sort of an example of an annotated entity that's that drives the mapping process. Notable thing here is you can use the app persistence constructor to say, when you create my entity, use this constructor rather than the default constructor, which is quite nice. And then there's also generic repositories where you just define your repository interface that extends Mongo repository, and then you can define a find method like find by last name. Use this bit of metadata to tell Spring Data how to find your Mongo, how to find your generic repositories and which Mongo template to use to connect to the database. And once you've done that, you can then just inject your repository into your service class and then just call save, find to load it, or find by last name. And you don't actually have to write any implementation. That's generated for you on the fly. And the find by last name is particularly interesting because that's a dynamic finder, and its name follows a certain sort of naming convention, namely find by property name. And so when that's invoked, Spring Data knows, well, you're trying to, well, it generates a query that does a find by the last name property. So, I mean, I've used an analogous approach on a Hibernate project. And, you know, we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of lines of Java code, and I think we've got about 2 explicitly coded repository classes in the whole system, and everything else is just generated, is just driven by a generic repository mechanism. It's really quite nice. Then there's also support for this query DSL project where it actually it uses an annotation processor to generate query classes from your domain objects so that you can then write these type safe composable queries. So it generated a QPerson class from my person class that then lets me create a query predicate looking like this. And then I can just call find all passing the repository, passing the predicate in as an argument. And the advantage of that is that you know, even though writing using some queries, sort of textual query language is quite straightforward, the problem you have is, well, if your domain model changes, you're not going to find out at runtime that your query is invalid, right? So what this does is, because it's, you know, using code generation, if you change your domain model incompatibly, you're going to get a compilation error. And it's going to tell you to go fix your query. Plus, you get completion and all the other things that your IDE provides. So that's kind of interesting. And then finally, Spring Data for MongoDB supports cross-store persistence. So here's my JPA entity. And then I put at related document annotation on this field. And what that does is, so when you save that entity, this gets inserted into MongoDB. And then when that entity is loaded, you know, part of it comes out of the relational database, the other part comes out of MongoDB. So it's sort of able to kind of leverage both persistence paradigms within the same entity, and which is pretty interesting. I know at Spring One, there was actually, in the keynote, there was a demo of using a similar approach with Neo4j as well. Okay, so that's sort of Spring Data in a nutshell. And, you know, over the remaining 20 minutes before beer time, just going to show you some more examples of that. Oh, that one? Yeah, so the question was, well, what about sort of transactional consistency between the relational database and between MongoDB? And it's like, yeah, it's not bulletproof. So you sort of have to kind of write your application in a way that you have to be mindful of that. Cheers. Unfortunate, but just sort of a fact of life. Please, no more difficult questions. All right, so kind of now I want to just kind of go through a quick case study from my book. So in the book, the actual example application for my book is called Food to Go, and it's all about a website where a customer goes there, enters an address and a delivery time. It's all about delivering takeout food. And so, you know, you go there, you type in your home address, you say when you want the food to be delivered. First thing the system has to do is display a list of restaurants that are available for delivery. And the criteria for that are, each restaurant serves a set of zip codes, and it's open at certain times of the day. And in order to deliver your order, it has to serve your zip code, and has to be open at the time you want the food delivered. And so, you know, the domain model looks like that. You know, we've got a restaurant. It's got a service area field that's a collection of zip codes. We've got an opening hours field that's a collection of time range objects, so day of the week, opening time, closing time. And it's got a collection of menu items as well. So, you know, that's pretty easy to persist in a relational database. Few tables, restaurant table, restaurant zip code table, restaurant time range table, right? You know, particularly interesting is the time range table, because it's the restaurant ID, day of the week, open time, closing time, so on. And then to actually query this in a relational database, not a big deal, just a three-way join between those tables. Okay, so, you know, so when I wrote the book, that, you know, it's kind of all about Hibernate and JDO and JDBC, so that was sort of, you know, the example that I used. So, well, what about doing this with Redis? So on the one hand, kind of mapping an entity like the restaurant class to the database, to Redis, is pretty straightforward, right? So, you know, these are key value pairs, right? So, you know, there's many different ways of doing it. So, like at the bottom, I just have a key, which is the restaurant. Well, rest is a prefix, could rest for restaurant. And then the ID of the restaurant is the suffix, and I could just have a big JSON string, right? That's one way of doing it. or I could have the same key, and then I could just use a map value where the map contains all of the attributes of that object hierarchy. Or if I wanted to have a different approach would be to use multiple key value pairs, so put all of the details in a map, put the service area in a set, and then have the opening hours just have a set containing the IDs of the time ranges. So there's sort of a bunch of different ways you could do it, right? And there's sort of various trade-offs. But, you know, this is a key value store. We don't have queries. So the problem you have with this approach is you can't query it to find the restaurants that are available, you know, that serve the zip code and that are open at a particular time. All you can do really is just get restaurants by primary key. And that sort of leads us to an important lesson about NoSQL databases is that unlike in the relational world where effectively your schema just reflects in a pretty straightforward way the data model, in the NoSQL world, you basically, the queries actually drive the sort of the quote database schema, which is very, very different. So, you know, you've got to think about how you want to query the data, and that determines how you represent it in the database. Or another way of thinking about it is you have to build up your own indexes. So with that said, it's like, well, how the heck can a key value store support a query that, you know, in SQL corresponds to a three-way join, has a couple of equality operations, and then two less than or equals? You know, there seems a big kind of conceptual gap between the two approaches. But, you know, if you break it down, first thing you can do is, well, think about how do you simplify a query in the relational world, and what you do is you denormalize the data, right? So if we denormalize, you know, those tables, basically we're pre-joining them, that actually eliminates the joins, and we end up with a significantly simpler query. And we can actually take it a step further by, you know, rather than worrying about the opening time in the query, we just worry about the closing time and then do the sorting. So I do the filtering back in the client. We end up with an even simpler query. All we've got is, well, no joins, two equality operations, and one less than. And the reason that I wanted to eliminate the less than will become apparent in a minute. But just by pre-joining that data, we've simplified the query dramatically. The other thing you can do is, well, if you've got two equalities, right, where column one equals some value, column two equals some value, in a key value world, you just concatenate the values and then you can just do a single get. So, you know, a big thing here is sort of composite keys in essence. And you can imagine if you wanted to, you do something similar in the relational world. And then finally, you can use what Redis calls sorted sets to do range queries. So a sorted set in Redis is a set, as you'd expect, but each set member has a score that's a numeric value. So when you put something into the set, you specify the member value plus the member's score. And what's particularly useful about that is that there's a Z range by score command that takes the key of the ordered set, and then you specify a min score value and a max score value, and it retrieves those members whose scores fall within that particular range. And you're probably wondering, Jesus, what's going on here? But you can leverage this. You can basically think of a sorted set as an index. And so what you end up doing is the actual member value is the opening time concatenated with the restaurant ID, and the score is the closing time. And so you can then find all of the restaurants that serve a particular zip code on a particular day of the week by just Z range by score, and the score range is from the delivery time to the end of the day. So you're sort of basically doing a query against an index. And so you get back a list of opening times concatenated with the restaurant IDs, and then you can just kind of filter that and you get back a set of restaurant IDs that are open at your delivery time. And so you can then make another query to then go get the actual information about each restaurant. So, you know, I kind of have a next slide. It's like, what the heck did you just tell me to do, right? Kind of going back to the cartoon. We didn't quite write a distributed map reduce function, but it's sort of clearly not as trivial as using a relational database. So here's a little bit of code that does this. So we're using a string Redis template that's provided by Spring Data. Here's the find available restaurants method that takes the delivery address, the delivery time, and just kind of gets some values out of it, the time of day, the day of week. And then it calls closing times this line is actually doing the Z range score by. And these values that can form the composite key. And then this is the min score value and the max score value. And then it's going through and finding the restaurant IDs that are actually open. And then it's kind of going off and using this multi-get operation to get a bunch of values in one go. So the parameter, the argument is the set of keys, and you get back that set of values. So the code itself is quite straightforward, even though we've sort of a lot of thought went into coming up with a data model. Here's some Spring Java config for setting this up, so using a connection factory and so on and so forth. So that's sort of, standard Spring code, but sort of translated into the Mongo world. Any questions about that? Does anyone want beer right now? Okay. But it gets easier. Well, actually, it gets harder first, but then it gets easier. So Cassandra, in a way, the data model is similar. It's different from Redis, but it sort of it's similar at the same time. And so you could then represent an entity, a restaurant entity in the same way, right, where you've got a row represents the entity and the columns represent the various attributes of that object graph, right? Or you could have a single column that stores the JSON for the entire thing. But just like with Redis, you can't actually query it, right? Because you can only get things using a slice or something approximating a slice. So you end up with a sort of kind of a similar approach where you end up having to denormalize the data. So the key is the delivery zip code and the day of the week. And then the super column value is the opening time. And then the actual column values that's the closing time, and the column value is the opening time concatenated with the restaurant ID. So it's kind of like the Redis approach, but by sort of taking a restaurant entity and denormalizing it into a set of columns like this, you can then just do a slice, super slice on it to get back all the restaurants that are open at that particular time, or at least haven't closed yet. So once again, you kind of had to think through a process of, here's my data model, here's how I want to query it, how the heck am I going to represent that given what Cassandra provides me with? Here's the code. It's actually written using Hector. And, basically see it ends up... It creates a query, a slice object. And it's kind of a hideous API, actually. It populates it with the values and then executes it and then iterates through the data that you get back. If anything you can take away from this slide is that Spring Data needs to support Redis to simplify it so you don't have... needs to support Cassandra so you don't have to see hideous code like this. Yes? Yeah, I think everybody heard that comment. I mean, it is in a way, the other way of looking at it, which doesn't make it seem quite as bad, is in the relational world, you have to come up with a set of indexes to support the queries that you want to create, right? So if you view what's really being created here as indexes that you kind of had to think hard about, it doesn't seem quite as bad, I would claim. But, you know, I suppose the thing is if you have a problem with your relational database, whether it's one of scale or your data model, you know, you need a flexible schema, you're already in a world of pain, right? And so if you, by leveraging one of these technologies, even though they're kind of weird and unfamiliar, you actually solve your scalability problem, then, you know, things are quite good. Okay. So this, we can actually finish on a positive note, though. So if you actually, so we're going to lastly look at MongoDB. And I think as you've already seen, a restaurant can be trivially mapped to a MongoDB document. Well, the restaurant, its menu, its opening hours and service areas is trivially mapped to a MongoDB document, right? So we've got a service area that's the list of zip codes. We've got the opening hours that's the list of time ranges. So it's a very direct mapping, which sort of illustrates one of the benefits of the document model. Plus, it's really easy to query. So we didn't actually, you know, unlike with Redis and Cassandra, we didn't actually have to jump through too many hoops to, you know, come up with a data representation that's queryable, because MongoDB is, you know, just supports it quite straightforwardly. And once again, because the code is supported, you know, MongoDB is supported by Spring Data, there's a nice template, you know, so we can inject that into our repositories. There's also a query builder that I'm leveraging here to build up the queries. So it's like, you know, almost English, where the service area is the delivery address's zip code, and then I want to do an LM match on the opening hours, where the day of the week is the day of the week from the delivery time, and the opening time is, you know, less than closing time is less than. And then I just call mongo template.find, passing in the collection name and the available and the class, the target class, and I get back a collection of available restaurants. And the template is doing all of the mapping from the document to the creating an available restaurant object and populating it from the document. And then, you know, there's some setup to create the right index. So quite nice. You know, it's sort of simpler and it's sort of more direct and so on than the other ones. Once again, here's some Spring Java config, you know, creating the database connection and so on, and creating the template and the like. So, you know, sort of, it's interesting. I didn't set out to make MongoDB look good, but it kind of gives you a flavor that it's actually quite nice. Though I think big takeaway with sort of any of these technologies, though, is that you do actually have to pick the right one for your application. And even though sort of Redis is on first surface is, you know, but, you know, for this particular sort of use case, it was quite complicated to come up with a data representation. There might actually be some benefits. And I hate to talk about benchmarks because, you know, everybody, you know, if I say something negative about your favorite database, you'll criticize the benchmark and so on. But it was funny because I just decided, well, I'm going to, you know, these databases are fast, right? I read the website and they said they were super fast and so on. So I wrote a simple benchmark, and what I was doing, I actually managed to find this open source collection of restaurants from all around the world. And there were like 29,000 of them in the US, and I think I multiplied by 10. So I was inserting 290,000 restaurants. And so there was a few sort of micro benchmarks I did. One was, there was sort of two different database formats. And one was just for primary key retrieval. So I put a, you know, so just configuring or inserting the data so I can just get a restaurant by primary key. And then the other one was inserting all that extra data to get the, so I can do the available restaurant query. And so the benchmarks are kind of interesting in as far as sort of like compared with MySQL, which I may or may not have set up correctly, you know, but I just try. You know, for some of the tests, these databases were amazingly fast, like orders of magnitude faster than MySQL, particularly with doing inserts. I mean, MongoDB is just so fast when it comes to inserting data. Though if you want to hear a rebuttal, you should go Google MongoDB is web scale to actually find out some of the reasons it's fast. But then when it came to doing inserts for find available restaurants, which is actually inserting, basically because some of these databases I had to denormalize the data, there were actually a lot more inserts. And you can see that, you know, databases, Redis was merely fast as opposed to awesomely fast, right? And Cassandra sort of dropped down to barely much faster than MySQL. Though interestingly, you can always scale Cassandra by just adding more servers to scale up your write capacity, which is not something you can do with a SQL database. But then, like, you know, I jumped through all of those hoops with Redis, and yet, you know, but the benefit was huge, right? Like, data inserts were blindingly fast for the most part, and then querying for find available restaurants was, you know, yet again an order of magnitude faster than MySQL. So you think, well, yeah, I had that weird and wacky representation, but things are going 10 times faster as a result of that. Some of these numbers I'm a little disappointed by, and I think it needs further research. But on the other hand, you know, for sort of find by just primary key, Cassandra was pretty fast as well, and it was pretty fast at doing inserts as well. So that's sort of my talk, and I guess beer is time for beer. But, you know, sort of in summary, it's like relational databases are great, but, you know, there's a bunch of problems with them. And then NoSQL databases can solve some of those problems, but you're sort of giving up something. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, you know, the transactional model is limited, right? And then, as you've seen, for some of them, you have to pick a sort of, you know, non-intuitive data representation to make it queryable. But sometimes the benefits are just huge, right? Like, you're 20x faster inserts or database accesses can make that worthwhile. But then, as sort of these, you know, the mixed performance numbers shows, you actually have to carefully pick the NoSQL database that just best fits your application or fits your application's use cases. And I think, you know, in general, I think the direction we're going to move in is sort of a polyglot persistence architecture where we're going to use a mixture of databases, relational or non-relational databases within the same app. So that's my talk, and hope you found it useful. Thank you.
Thanks to Chris Richardson for coming out and speaking at ETE this year. Sign up for our news and events emails, and you'll be in the know. Head over to chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup and fill out the form. We'll send you regular newsletters that include technology news, podcast and blog and screencast links, and information about our upcoming events. The URL again is chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup. We'll also post it on our TechCast site, techcast.chariotsolutions.com.